On this episode of Old Time Muskie Radio, we go all the way back to 1943 for the episode entitled Timmy Caught a Bass.
Ma, Dad, you'll never guess what happened. Down by the river today, I caught a big bass.
What?
No!
No son of mine is gonna go bass fishing. No son of mine is gonna go bass fishing. You're gonna fish muskies. What's next? You're gonna shake hands with a Chinaman? Folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 podcast, A Ghoulish J. It is Halloween-ish.
It's coming right down the right around the corner, Steve. It's coming up Friday.
Frosting your pumpkin, as they say.
No, but some people at work are. Awareness Week.
Every day's Pumpkin Awareness Week in the Northwoods.
Well, Tom's got his own pumpkin stand. I don't know if I ever told you that one.
I'm aware. He's kind of a pumpkin kind of guy. So I think he's growing some, you know. What do you got to do? It's called a side hustle, Jay. It's what the kids
do. It is. Very lucrative one, too.
Oh, should have been in the pumpkin game, they say.
And it's the honesty system for pain, too. He's just got a little pail there next to the pumpkin.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Pumpkin pail. Give me a break. Whatever. True trusting. I know where I'm going to go get some quick cash here in a minute. Who keeps clearing?
Highway K, Rhinelander.
Highway K, Rhinelander. But just a bucket of pumpkin cash.
You know,
these people have those like, geotag searches, right? They're looking for hidden treasure. People are now hunting down Tom's pumpkin cash.
He's probably gonna get robbed tonight. It's all my fault.
I'll cover the $13. Sorry, Tommy boy. But that was what we were gonna survive on over the winter. Anyway, goodness.
Life of a farmer, man. It's tough.
Don't steal pumpkin cash, folks. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Nope.
Anyway.
What's going on with you?
It is pouring the buckets.
I saw the radar this morning. Okay. Yeah.
It's porn buckets. So other than that, doing the do. But it has been one of those kooky weeks. We're into that fall time where it is going or it's not going. And it is anyone's guess a little bit, you know, trying to get weird water temps. I've heard some really good reports from a couple different people. Just as far as catching some big fish, I know Danny was out doing his thing still, and like Jamie Pastilli and Smitty, Jake Smith, he looked like he poked a pig, as they say, and got a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's for me right now, I'm looking for a little bit more of a water temperature dip. You know, there's you get these doldrums, these weird little isolated bands of temperature where they're just kind of like meh. They'll look at it, they'll come in, you know, and you're like, just eat the freaking thing. So still scoring, though, don't get me wrong, still scoring. It's just one of those matters where you're going wacky and wild stuff.
Wild and wacky stuff.
Wild and wacky stuff, believe it or not. Deep into the heart of October, shockingly, still new stuff showing up at the shop. You got Lee delivered what? The Death Paws minnow?
Yeah, new size, 7.5
is there.
Yeah, he's been crushing fish on those too.
Looks like
he's been on his trips lately.
Got Leviathans in. No, that's never mind. Different. My apologies. That is the CNCs are back in. So what has he done here? Okay, I was just glancing here. So they've got the, oh, there's a CNC shake and crank.
That's new.
That's
correct.
New. What's going on here? What do we have here? 6.5 shake and crank.
Yep. It's kind of half jerkbait, half crankbait, the way they describe it. We have not thrown it yet. It literally came in 4 hours ago.
Oh, really? That's how new it is.
Yeah. Hopefully tomorrow. I think it's supposed to be nice, so I'll try to get out. But yeah, he says treat it like a jerkbait. Actually, he said like 2/3 jerkbait, 1/3, if you do the math. Yeah, crank. So it's got a round lip design. Hard to see from the picture. So, and that little hatchet blade on the back.
Very cool.
Tick, a little bit of flitter.
Very cool.
And yeah, restocked and with some new colors on some of the other sizes.
Got their diving rise looking sharp as always here, ear. And you got, so you got a rubber tail and you have the hatchet blade rear section as well. Looking cool. Do they add some new colors, I think, too?
A couple new colors, yeah.
Very cool. Yep. Looking good. Those are neat, neat baits for sure. What else? Okay, so you've got all those back in. New beanies, folks. Stop calling the shop. They finally got the new beanies.
Stay warm.
No, that's cool. Nice. I dig
it. It's warm. Mm-hmm.
Then you have, Jay, what everyone's been waiting for.
Lay it on me.
The kids are been waiting. Adults, everybody. The Muskie Shop coloring book.
And activity book. This has brain teasers in it too, Steve. It's very cool.
I tried them. I couldn't figure them out.
You couldn't.
Elmer's,
he's perplexed by the whole thing. He's fascinated by it. So I got to do a video with Elmer, you know, talking about this new book because he says it's fun for kids of all ages, even me, he says.
These puzzles are impossible.
Well,
number 9, a cross rubber bait with a paddle tail. Impossible. It's like these were made for children, Jay.
Kid could figure it out, not us.
Help the angler get out of the weeds. My brain. I'm not smart enough for these puzzles. How fun. That is the, you know what it is? We're getting there. People, if you're like, what are they doing? You're getting around the holiday season. And there you go. Got that for some reason. You guys went nuts and bought a 64-pack of crayons. So somebody, you know what's going to happen? Somebody's going to walk in a shop and buy this and just dump those in the backseat of their minivan, Jay. It's going to be Cheerios and crayons everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's always fun. I think I know somebody that worked on that coloring book. Got some loon action in there. How fun. Good on it.
Fun way to get the kids involved.
If you
involved,
can,
you know,
solve
awesome.
All the puzzles in this, which are impossible, right? They were Dr. Bob tried, failed miserably.
Guess I haven't looked that closely at them, but
right?
Okay.
If you can solve these, you win one of those free wristbands that Tom bought into the store that was supposed to deter bugs, but they've been out of date for 2 years.
Yeah, the bug band thing. Sure, gotcha.
Yeah, you
okay.
get two of
okay.
them.
You okay, it's a two-pack. All righty. This is exciting. Exciting giveaway.
Stuff. It's exactly what you're looking for. Too cool. There's gonna.
Speaking of giveaways, Steve, we have not done one in a long time. We should do some holiday giveaways, some big ones this year.
Or not.
Oh, okay.
No, we should. We should do something. Yeah. Why don't we do something for Halloween? You got anything up your sleeve?
Not yet.
We could, if you rob Tom's pumpkin honesty box. No, decent.
Take a selfie that. Next to Tom's pumpkin patch on Highway K.
Highway
and
K.
You will get a free bait, guaranteed.
Don't do that. That's borderline creepy. But if you did, Jay wouldn't be mad. No. Yeah, we need Jay work on something there. If you could, I've been running and gunning here, but we should come up. Why don't we do that for like the holiday, you know, basically November, December?
Sure.
We'll run. What if we did 8 weeks of winning? I don't know. Come up with something. I got more freaking. My problem is this. I still have not unpacked, Jay, and this is just ridiculous. Sitting here in the bait cave, I kid you not, there's a 55-gallon tote of musky baits that are thrown on top of each other. Right. I mean, just thrown in there from Canada. I've still not sorted out. So I took everything that was laying on the dock, deck of my boat, and they like on the porch of the cabin, just threw it in a tote, and I've still not had time to sort them out. So there are plenty of baits to give away here.
And then I can picture it. Yeah, I remember the scene when grisly. You got back.
Yeah, it's grisly. And then I've got freaking out in the living room. I'm getting in trouble here, like boxes. It's like I have all the stuff. So, yeah, let's clear some of this out. We will do Win Steve Stash, or however we want to phrase it, come up with some stuff here. Maybe whoever writes the best musky limerick, Jay.
Mm-hmm.
There once was a hermit named Dave who kept a bait caster in his cave. So we'll come up with some stuff over the next couple weeks. Keep everybody motivated. That sounds like we thought it out, but we didn't. But that would be good over November, December for sure. So, Jay, how close? What are we looking at temps wise up there? What's kicking?
Yeah, upper 40s to real low 50s is the norm right now. So looks like a lot of lakes have turned over. Have completed the flip. Fishing's been pretty good. A lot of people, like we mentioned, Smitty, he had a good week, including one big one. Some other guides I talked to kind of had the same results. They got some really good fish. Sounds like jerkbaits. Sounds like big plastics were deeper suckers. And a handful of people I know have been trolling, too. So
yeah,
definitely kicking into that fall kind of repertoire deal.
Little bit of everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that time. You're going to see some big ones. I talked to Dr. Bob for a minute earlier this week, and you know he's seeing similar water temperatures, but not hearing a lot of action out of Minnesota. Really, you know, there's some fish, but as far as like, you know, even he kind of notated, they made that jump, really went from kind of that warm water period to kind of fell off the cliff there real quick on the water temperature thing. And so
okay
you know,
maybe their lakes, you know, they have such, you know, a vast amount of larger lakes too that have just needed a little bit more time. Maybe this is the week where there's a lot of them are completing turnover perhaps. So
well, and just transition, you know, you go from one extreme to the other too quickly and you end up with that, you know. So
yeah,
it'll be interesting here. So other than that, you know, I've been cranking out some stuff here, and you know, Jay, I write and do this and do that, but my head has been on a piece I was working on not for the app, but for another publication, just about big fish, right? Not, and I don't mean 50s, I mean like mega tankier scary ones, right? And it was funny, I was going to run it by you, because sort of what I was doling out here is just the relationship between the biggest fish and deep structure, right? And then something I couldn't put any other way, talking about like the contact point I talk about in Next Level Musky Fishing in the book, about how important that actual transition where structure and the main basin become indistinguishable. And it's so interesting. I was going back through, you know, as many catch logs as I could, and then looking, okay, where was this fish? Where was that fish? Where were we looking at? And I hadn't really sat down in eons, you know, saying it on the podcast, but sitting down looking at like the biggest of big fish, right? Like we're talking just mega tankers that I've been fortunate enough to catch. There's 100% a correlation between the deep basin and deep structure. And it was just something, you know, like I said, we talk about in the podcast, but just sit there and look at it and look, okay, no, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you know. And then I called Danny. I was talking to Danny Herbeck, just kind of making sure I wasn't crazy, because sometimes you sit down and write something and you go, okay, let's make sure I'm not too far afield. You know, I love conceptualizing things and coming up with my own theories and this, that, and the other. But, you know, I asked him, and I was kind of like, I don't want to say, not asking for approval, but just going, hey. And he was like, of course, immediately. You know, there was no doubt, you know, how I phrased it to him. And it's just so interesting, you know, of the commonality that I see when I'm talking to like a guy like Danny or talking to anybody else, between, and I'm, again, I'm not talking 50s. I'm talking mid-50s and you know, it could be a 54, but I'm talking monsters,
mm-hmm. right? Right.
And then, again, taking that and extrapolating from that what we've done in Europe and caught pike that are well above, you know, what they should be. You know, just as big as you can get. And that is such a common thread, you know, and I've been seeing it now. I haven't gotten anything like, I mean, I've gotten some 50s, don't get me wrong, but seeing that just throughout the habitat range and how crucial that is if you're just absolutely trying to dial in on the biggest of big. Like, you have to have a clear vision. You have to have a singular goal for that, though. You know, either, and it's just something you're going to dumb into or not. Like, the guys, you'll see a guy, okay, you know, he fishes his whole life, and then, boom, he caught a big fish on his third cast on Lake of the Woods, or, you know, these off stories where, you know, here goes Marv. Marv caught, you know, he's caught 30 muskies in his life, and he gets a double nickel, right? That's great. Good mm-hmm. for Marv. But there happened to be a corollary between Marv being on the right weed bed on the, like, on these singular days that these fish show up. And I think that's important to note, because they're just thinking again about everything that goes into where are these fish and what are they doing. The rarity of these fish coming in shallow, right? That it takes exceptional conditions or exceptional factors for the mm-hmm. biggest of the big to be in the areas that people are generally casting.
Agreed.
It's a rarity. And that's one thing I wanted to just kind of throw out in everybody's minds. We've going, at times you look at a body of water and go, okay, there's no big fish left, or we're not running into big fish, or nobody catches big fish, or blah, 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 right? And you and I have done it on some of these smaller Wisconsin inland lakes. You go, well, if you do it different, they're there, right? If you're not bank beaten, they're there. And it all comes back, and I think the tie-in of where I'm headed with this is the importance of structure, and just another point to just drive at home of understanding the interplay of the structural elements of a body of water, much less current and seasonality of how that plays. And then, you know, looking at it and just thinking about it, you know, writing that piece today, going that these fish, if you're willing to, and at times I am, and it depends on who I'm guiding, you know, because there's people that just want to catch one, and there's people want to catch a big one. Two different experiences. But the importance of fishing deep if you're really going for big fish. Because if you think about it by the numbers, and I look at, like, you know, obviously having Steve and Danny, you know, just to BS with all the time, or, you know, all these other guys I know, every time you start talking big fish, there's this either that's a story or a corollary between where that big fish was caught and deep water, or some knucklehead caught it on blades in the shallows. And if you look at it, the sample size that I have, like, the details on, right, where I can call you up and we can talk about it, and I know, hey, this was a 54, this was a 55, this was a tick above that, or in this exceptional zone, right? Like, these fish are an exception to the rule. They are beyond big. The majority of those fish that I know that, okay, I know that fish is really that big. I know the angler that caught it. They're a reliable narrator that can tell me when, where, and how, or how they guided to that fish as well, right? Whether they caught it or not. 99% of them are deep water adjacent, with just a few added in where someone just caught that fish. And every time, you know, it involves blades or a topwater or just an average angle or whatever the bait might be. When I hear that story and I ask the operative thing, well, what were the conditions like for what was taking place? It is like the stars have aligned. That's just abundantly clear, especially when I was researching this article going, okay, it's not just me. You know, I knew these things, but it kind of drove the point home a little bit more for me, just kind of revisiting that, you know, there's two ways to catch those monsters, which is The stars align. Conditions are perfect. It is the major. It is, you know, July. It is August. It is, you know, whatever. Everything's just spot on, or you're willing to suffer the deep structure. And that's really a line that, you know, if you want to cross that line, you got to be crazy. You're already nuts for fishing muskies. You know, you're already nuts for going out here and going, hey, you know, I'm going to go out here and beat my head against the wall for a bite. And then you're taking that and making it an even more difficult endeavor because we're looking at structure. And you know, again, on the other revisit is, if you want to know how to target those fish, you're talking about a micro population inside of an already small population, where we're talking one or two fish in a big system, right? Maybe an eagle. I don't know how many 55s there are. There's not a lot, but they're there, and there's fish bigger than that, right? And, but, you know, how many are there is anyone's guess. And where and what they're going to use. But like I said, just put it in your head, the biggest of the big fish is 99% being caught on deep structure related things. And that microcosm of the guys that were there on the day the stars align. And so, you know, it becomes obvious that if you want to target the biggest of big fish, you need to get away from the edges and get serious about deep structure. You know, and Jay, we've seen it sometimes where, you know, the biggest of big fish in any given body of water, it might be a 4-footer, right? Mm-hmm. You know, right. It might be a 4-footer.
Yeah, in a 300-acre lake,
right?
For example, sure.
Sure. It could be a 50, it could be a 47, but, you know, and it kind of struck me where, you know, every year I hear of one or two, you know, 50-inch fish coming on a system, say like the Three Lakes chain, right? Or Eagle River chain. You hear about them. 4-footer or 50, they happen. But how many, Jay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many here?
A few, yeah.
A few?
Yeah,
absolutely. Right. We hear of a few. How many anglers are there? A blue billion.
Yeah.
So, you know, at a certain point, there is not a weed or rock or, you know, shoreline that's left unchecked. Right. It's not like they're sitting there going, oh, I don't know. I didn't like the shade of that Hirsch's ghost tail. I'll wait for the next caller to go by. It's not what's happening. These systems where you hear of them spitting out one real big fish every now and again, that's a really strong indication that they're there. And if you have, I won't say adequate, but you have substantial angling pressure, well, guess what? They're just not targeting where they're at. So just a take. Hold on. What is this? The freaking phone. Yeah. You know? Oh, anyway. Make any sense there, Jaybird? Down the rabbit hole we go of craziness.
Well, yeah. I mean, look at it. The super monster fish in any system, I mean, they're just ranging deeper than the dinks, you know? They just are. They just do. They're safer down there, and they can survive and thrive on their own, and doing things just a stage deeper, where, like you said, where most anglers fail to target effectively.
Yeah, and I said, just delving into it, it's not something you sit there and vacillate about every day. Ooh, where'd I get you then, you know? But looking back, and I've been fortunate enough to handle, you know, more than one, and you know, you go, huh. And you, like I said, it starts checking the boxes. And again, you don't have enough to make a pattern from, but there's a pattern there of where you would want to be, where they're going to show up, and what that looks like. And I think that, again, I think that bodes true for, you could be fishing, like you said, a 300-acre lake or some lake in Ohio or this lake or that lake where, hey, if you're sick of catching, all we catch is 36s. I've heard that before. We catch, all I'm catching is 36s to 40s. Well, you know, it's possible that there's not bigger fish there, but I think there's a high probability that there's a much smaller population you can get into, right, of bigger fish if you're willing to do the work. And that's the trade-off. You know, that's always a trade-off of foregoing action for size class.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a tough one. And it's a tough one where, you know, it's difficult at times when you're going out there and going, okay, you know, old Billy caught three, you know, and things look great and conditions look great. And you're just going, listen, here's what I'm going to do. It's going to suck. And I'm going to not catch fish in hopes that I catch the fish. You know, and if you're done, I mean, there's guys, like I said, I had a guy in the boat this week. We were laughing, you know, the typical trope of went out there with his buddy, and it's like his first time he got like a 53 or a 52 or something, right? That's awesome. But, you know, and I don't recall if it's 52 or 53. It's still an exceptional, a great fish, right? Borderline exceptional, borderline like, whoa, right? But, you know, that's not just going to happen for everyone. If you really want to get in front of those fish to really target them, you know, and I think, you know, I think that mindset, I think a lot of people want to do that. I think a lot of people, it's hard if you're getting to fish X, Y, and Z days a year. You know what I'm saying? But I just bring that up from the standpoint, if you really want to change your musky fortunes, really dialing in on what that deep water bite is. And you have to spend time out there. It's not like you pull into the deep edge and go, oh, okay, it's on. No.
Yeah.
What were we going to say?
Well, yeah, if you are, you know, looking at, you know, XYZ amount of time to fish, right? Like
right.
Most people, you know, and you live in Pennsylvania, live in Ohio or Indiana or northern Wisconsin or whatever, up here, you know, there's a million small lakes, right? Mm-hmm. You hear information, you got your one trip of the fall, and you're probably going with buddies or whatever.
Yeah.
What do you want to do? You want to catch muskies, you know, you don't want to beat your head against the wall for a shot in the dark. So I think that's why most people are, you know, they hear, well, Billy got one, you know, or he got three on this weed line, you know, throwing bucktails in early October, whenever they went out. So you're going to probably try that because that's the information you have to contact fish and mm-hmm. get some fish in the boat. So yeah, it's a tough deal. And it's just like, yeah, I mean, what do you want to forsake in that attempt? You know, it's just like, do you want to go out and will there be a good chance, you know, you're not going to even see a fish if you're going with the deep structure route on a small lake? It's just to try to weed out that one hog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tough call.
Yeah, it's a tough call. You know, I mean, but
yeah,
it's
everyone's
doable.
Doing it for different reasons. It's doable.
You
know? Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of it I was working on, and I'll tell everybody about it later, but, you know, one of the publications I write for kind of went, you know, hey, it's winter's coming. Let's do something vulgar. You know, who doesn't like anything more than just vulgarly big musky pictures, Jay?
Oh, for Men's Quarterly?
Men's Quarterly, yes.
For which one?
It's better,
not that one.
Better Homes and Boating. But anyway, you know, one of those pieces where it just becomes this, you know, what can I throw in there? And the conversation arose from that. And then, you know, again, my brain's just spinning on how one does that, because I've had people just ask, how do you do that? How do you do that? And you go, you catch them. And then you start thinking, well, maybe not. And, you know, the devil's in the details as always.
All right.
With all things. And I mean, that's the clearest detail that I have, you know, to the dynamic of where are the mega tankers? Where does that equation? And like you said, I mean, you can't fault the guy. My goodness, go catch fish. Right. I mean, I'm not spending a lot of days doing this on the guide boat. I can attest to that. You know, I've got a few guys that are like, okay, I'll ask them what's the goal. You know, I know if they got fish under the belt, is it muskies or is it the?
Uh-huh.
And you go,
what do most people say? Or does it change for different times of the season?
No, never does. There's it is. Depends on time on the water and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had a guy ask me the other day. I can't remember what day it was. He's like, you know, do you ever pull? And this is every fish is a good fish. But he's like, do you ever pull off on them? I think earlier in the day. And later today, I had like upper 30s come in on blades. And I could have caught it. And I just didn't. I kind of went around. I told him, well, I don't bend over for fish that small. You know, I'm not gonna get sweaty on the eight for that one. And let's save him for a few more inches later.
Not worthy of the iron, as they say.
Not worthy. But again, there's a lot of days where you okay, that would have sufficed and that would have been the one. So mm-hmm. I would say it's 95% of people want to put a fish in the boat or they don't feel like it was a beneficial day.
Mm-hmm.
2% want to learn and the other 2% want to hog hunt. And the, you know, people just want, oh, you know, they want to see, they want the picture. They go, buh, here it is. But it's interesting with the guys. I actually, you know, had some, I think Cam, you know, he's a podcaster and all this stuff, came down as like, okay, let's forego the 36s, which is just a slightly different approach sometimes, but kind of how you're focused and narrowing your scope. And I would say the other thing that comes to targeting big fish is something I'm always harping on, which is saturation casting, but how close you have to get to them. One would think that the biggest of big fish, you know, the neophyte thought would be they're big, aggressive, mean, they're the biggest and baddest, when really they're the slowest and the saddest. You know, they're not going to come raging with their hair on fire. I've seen it, and it scared the bejesus out of me, right? I mean, I have had, we were laughing on the boat yesterday. We had a fish that I would think was 54 to 55 come in about, oh gosh, 4 feet of water in the eight with somebody I was fishing with this year in Canada, and it scared the bejesus out of everybody, right? You're just completely, and again, guards were down, we're having a fun time, right? Shouldn't be a big fish here right now kind of scenario. Now, structurally, it checks right. Every box, right? If you can imagine, Jay, you have an island that's about 30 feet across, situated in a cup bay with two deep reefs in the front of it, right?
And you're going to say that, yeah.
It's just right. Gnarly. And the deepest, right. Clearest water in the body of water we were fishing.
Okay.
You know, should have had it together. And a lot of times when I pull in that area, when I'm hitting it and I tell people I'm fishing with, like, all right, pay attention, this is a rubber meets the road area, right?
Cool.
And that one kind of didn't. We're just like, you know, come in and here it came, you know, and you're like, ah, oh, God. And I mean, you can't turn it, it's a freaking rocket ship, right? And it that's a rarity that you see them, you know, moving that quick. But
this is back in peak water temps, though, too.
Peak water temps.
Yeah, late July or something, probably.
During that period, too. Remember, mm-hmm. You know, this summer it was like adhering to the moon gods. Like, everything is on moon. Don't even fish if it's not on moon, right?
Yeah, it was for a while, right?
It was. And you were just, you would let your guard down. I shouldn't even got in there in that area. And you go, oh, man, that was the one. And, you know. But I say that from the standpoint of also, too, when I have seen big, and I'm talking big bigs, 54, 55, when I've seen them in shallow, it is either the primest of prime of prime, 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 right? Or at weird times. And something I was working on, too, is looking at kind of the, and I don't have it because I got to get a hold of Herbie, old Herbie. And check his kind of his data, if you will, of the percentage that he has in prime conditions versus cold fronts, right? I'm heavily weighted in cold fronts of the biggest of big fish I've ever caught, right? Bad, bad, bad conditions. Danny's kind of somewhere in the middle, and I want to see where Herbie ends up, right? And then after that, my pick up the telephone and how many legals have you got, meaning 54 plus is narrow, right? I've, you know, there's a guy here, this guy's got one or he's got two, you know what I'm saying? Give me a guy with two, but you know, there's not many people that have one or more, right? And therein lies the question of like, you, again, I'm working with folks an exceptionally small sample size of, you know, between myself, Danny, Steve, what I know of some of Booker's catches and what I know of some others, you know, it's still not a tremendous amount of fish. We don't have this wide sample size, but you just go anecdotally, you know, the on the water experience says this. You know, it's just kind of an interesting take, but you know, a lot of cold fronts, Jay, for me.
Well, we've talked about that at depth many times, actually, about that whole cold front thing. It's just like, you know, if you look at Joe's or, you know, Big Paul's, you know, biggest fish pictures, it's like, oh, look at the background sky. You know, it's like cloudless or there's some big fluffy clouds, you know. It's that post-frontal kind of winds north. It's light quite often, usually. And it's like big fish show up. And, yeah, we talked about that. It's just something that's kind of crazy.
It's one of those things, you know, we don't...
But we have our theories.
Yeah, you don't sit here and beat your brains to death on, okay, I'm looking here. Look, so Danny sent me a support photo for that piece I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
And the water has the slight, I mean, for Eagle, this is not even windy. It's just the slightest ripple. Bright high skies. Mm-hmm. There's not a cloud in the I'm looking, let me zoom in. Everybody does this. I'm zooming in on his sunglasses, Jay, to see if case there's no clouds in his sunglasses either, by the way. Sorry. Nobody else did. I know everybody does. Have you ever realized that, Jay? Everybody zooms on everything on every muskie picture. If you're not,
you're a
fool. But there's not a cloud in the sky in that picture, which is just a gargantuan fish. And so, yeah, you know, cold front, which has been, you know, some of these big fish. And we, you know, a lot of times we're talking about these fish moving in or getting active on a cold front, you know, 4-footers, 50s, 51, 52. And that's really where the common cutoff is, 52. There's 52s and change, 52 and a half, 52 and three quarters, 52 and a quarter. You know, don't get me wrong, that's a monster fish, right? Monster fish. But that's your common cutoff. And you'll see those move up in the cold front and you'll see it. But like I said, those monsters, that's a different league kind of fish, you know, tend to pop up there. Anyway, let's get to some Q&A here, guys.
Well, I've got a Q&A.
What?
Well, can I read it?
No.
This is Jay from St. Germain writes.
This is not how this show works, sir.
First time caller, long time listener, something like that. Steve, maybe you'll know the answer to this. Everybody knows about fall fishing for muskies. Why are the windows short and furious in the fall? Can you explain that?
Is this just something you've made up?
Yeah.
This is not how the show works, sir. Why are the windows?
What's up with the short, intense windows in the fall? No, serious question. I don't know. I have no idea.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, I've heard a lot of opinions.
Okay.
I lived through it yesterday and I was like, there he is. Right.
And then it's gone.
Then it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I've heard opinions. I've yet to see something on my graph or something happen climactically that explains it, where we go, boom, this is why, right? And you know, it's so odd where I think with the fall bite, you know, and again, let me preface again with, especially with live imaging of you know, at times in the past, you go, forage is really moving, bait fish are really moving, things are up in the water calmer, things are darting around or moving, right? I don't see that. I see, like, you know, here's the deep old weed edge, here's some bait fish on the bottom, boom, all hell breaks loose, nothing changed.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. There's no, like, bellwether of, uh-oh. Yeah. You know, this is happening. Now, it would be of note, and I am no avian expert, sir. Let me preface with that. you know, you'll notice in the summer months, in the warm period, you'll see birds doing things. Loons are feeding, you know, cranes are gobbling minnows in the shallow, which is always a good sign that bait fish are shallow, right? And then subsequently predators and all these different little bellwethers. You know, in the fall, you really don't have the birds feeding. They've migrated. They're doing different things, right?
True.
There's really, okay, like, no visual cue on that end of things. Everything's happening deeper in general. So to know what's happening is just not the same read of the water. And I rely, when the colder the water gets, the more I rely on electronics, primarily now live imaging, right? I'll say it, don't care. But I'm not using it to find muskies. I'm using it to go, oh, that's happening or not happening, or where is a bait fish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where are the schools of bait? Are they moving? Are they not moving? Are they just? Is it just a ball of bait fish doing nothing? Are those walleyes active? Because you don't have any surface clues. You don't have any surface read. You have far less feedback. And I think that's a difficult part in the fall where if you've noticed, the reports aren't, you know, you said Jake Smith, he's text me at picker, got a real doozy of a fish, right? And that's been my week yet again. Last week was, got a couple pant shitters, right? And the same thing happened this week. No in between. No, like, oh, we had a pretty good day. We got a couple, you know, this, that, and the other. Got a 42 and a 46. No, it's like, okay, here comes Goliath or not. And the ones that you encounter are just fired up. Now, I have a theory, which is, you know, a lot of times we're trying to get fish to come up higher in the water column than they want to because we're casting, right, during the fall. And maybe it is a little bit more, there's a more, you know, fevered activity below, but like I said, I'm not seeing it on the graph, so I really can't articulate. I can tell you what I don't know. I can't tell you, boom, I know this and this is why. I just know you better be casting or trolling. You don't stop, you know, and it's that tight bite window period. Another thing I noticed in the fall, Jay, I guess to that kind of that same point, is that later sunset bite doesn't happen. That's another thing that I've always found odd in the fall. Once the light angle starts to break, right, you get the
heat of the day is good, but when it starts to fade, it slows off.
Well, they'll kick up when the heat of the day is good, right, for sure. Just like spring and fall transitional mm-hmm. periods, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not a big morning guy in the spring or the fall. Heat of the day's pretty good. You get a light angle change, and that's the only thing that I notice, and that might be the answer to your question, but I can't say that it is. Where the light angle changes, everything pops off, and then it's done, and then, you know, you could beat your brains in for an hour after dark, and nothing's going to happen. Right? Or you could go all the way to dark, and it's just diminishing returns after kind of that light change. You know, I told somebody on the boat this week, I said, I catch most of my muskies this time of the year before I get to that point of the day where, you know, do I leave the sunglasses on or off kind of time, right? You know what I'm talking about? There's that gloaming. They're hitting the boat before that. Now, you know, every once and again, you'll grind it out and you'll get one later than, but that seems to generally be my take. Again, is it a light angle thing? Is it light penetration? Is it the heat of the day? The timing has changed. Like you said, the bite windows are discernible that time of year. Does that answer your question, young man, sir? You win a prize.
What do I win? Nothing.
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 Ben, do you tee your hooks? I thought if a hook was bent, it would be weaker where it was bent. If this is true, are you sacrificing some strength by teeing your hooks? So, guys, if you don't know teeing your hooks, you're folding them out to spread the gap. Always do that, if you will, on the unwelded side of a hook. Right? Grab yourself, folks. People driving down the road right now, Jay, sitting at work. Grab the treble hook closest to you. You probably keep some in the console of your car if you're serious about this. hold on, dear. Pull over. The podcast boys just said we need to delve into our hook stash that we keep in the Miata. Anyway, so if you look at a hook, there is a barb. A treble hook has three barbs, as we know. One of them is welded on. So two are cast together. One is welded or braced on, whatever you want to call it, right? Anytime I'm going to tee a hook, I always address the two points that are not welded on. I don't want to put any torque, if you will, on the braced welded side. So I'm going to tee a hook. I'm going to do it on that the two hooks that are one cast as one.
Sounds like a smart play. Right? Sure.
So what that entails and what I'm trying to get at, don't just go grabbing your bank and go, I'm going to tee the hooks. You need to look how it's orientated on the split ring and laying against the body first.
Right. You might have to take it off and then reattach it in the proper.
Right. Because the folks that put that hook on were not paying attention. They were going, how many more hooks do I have to put on today?
Right. I deal with that daily. And they're just put on randomly by 99% of manufacturers are not put on.
There's no reason. They're not. It's not their job unless they come pre-teed. Now, why do we tee our hooks or when will we tee our hooks? Right? Which I think is the overarcher. Flat baits. We're thinking Suix. We're thinking Titans. We're thinking any bait that is wider than the hook itself. I tend to tee the hooks on pounders, right? I actually threw one this week. I kind of always lie. I'm never throwing one of those again, but I keep one in the boat. And I threw one just to see if I could, and it hurt. Mm-hmm. But on big rubber presentations, right, your flat-bodied, your Bulldogs and Reduces, I tee those hooks out.
Matlocks?
No.
No,
on okay. Matlocks.
That's got a wide enough
it's
hook.
It's a fat-bodied bait. With the matlocks, I generally catch them on the front or the back hook, and I'm actually running. And they might be stock. It's 7-0 on there. I think the matlock is a stock 7. Headlock is a Eagle Claw 6. We could look at the Muskie Shop hook library that we have on the app there. I forgot about that. Need to update again on the winter, but that's always a good thing when we're talking hooks. If you don't know, that's on the app. There is a hook library that tells you every hook that we can get the info from, which is most of them at the store, of what the direct replacement is for. But yeah, Matlock's a fat bait. I've not had any problems with that. I've not. And it's probably because we're not trying to rip it through rubber, right? Or like with a dive and rise bait, the fish is hitting it, grabbing it on the float back. You know what I'm saying? Trolling, you're just dragging it. He's going to hit it. By the time he hits it, he doesn't have a hook in him. His face skates into it would be my guess. A lot of my headlocks and matlocks have noticeable scratches. Like if he's T-boning, it drug him about, an inch before he got hooked. But, I mean, if you're low percentage hooking on that, you could. But mainly I'm thinking jerk baits. Like I said, Titan, Suix, Bobbies, and then my Medusas and Bulldogs. I'll tee those out. Now, with that being said, I like to have those flat against the body, so I actually go back to the old trick of using rubber bands against those. One of my favorite things to use to mod baits is dentist rubber bands or the little tight rubber bands they'd use to braid hair. And you can hold that hook tight against the body if not worried about banging around. But, he asked about the weakness. I mean, anytime you bend metal, you're weakening it. So I've never thought about that. It's never been a consideration because I've never seen a failure, right? I say that because we're bending the non-welded part of the hook. But you're not sitting there like bending the bend of the hook, right? So if you're teeing it out and flattening the surfaces out, it's a different flex point than it would be bending the actual curvature of the hook, which would make me worry there. Make any sense, Jay?
Yeah, we're talking about massive hooks here.
They're incredibly
strong. It's like split ring overkill. You know, we get that question a lot. It's like, how many pounds brake strength is that number 7 super ring? It's like, don't know exactly, but if it's over 200 pounds, don't worry about it. You're not going to damage it.
Yeah, I will say that split rings are, shockingly, if most people knew, the split rings are one of your weakest points on any bait. Doesn't matter what it is. Hate to say that, but most of them are, because it's just a tiny key ring, Jay. We stole those from tiny people, and now they don't have anywhere to put their keys. Jeff, hello. I'm getting into musky fishing here. Pros talk about spinner rods, jerkbait rods, topwater rods, sucker fishing rods, etc. I assume they differ in length, action, etc. Can you explain the difference in all these rods? Also, what is a good starter rod? Okay. So, Jeff, our take has always been one rod to rule them all. Right? To keep it succinct for everybody else, get a rod that physically lets you figure eight without bending over. You're going to have a good figure eight when you're flat footed. If you don't know how to figure eight really well, we got awesome videos on the Musky 360 app, as well as the Musky Shop TV channel on the tube of you. Right. So we want a rod that is physically appropriate for our height, also physically appropriate for how high the gunwale is on our boat. Right. Which is generally going to range anywhere from, my opinion, 8.6 to 9.6, depending on your height. As far as all the multiple rod things, I don't think you need them. Right. I've been able to do everything that I've done for decades with one rod. The only time I break out a specified rod is when I'm trolling or if I need an extra heavy action, right? So I will fish an extra heavy rod when I'm fishing big rubber baits like bulldogs, medusas, and krakens, right? And that's about it. Now, the elites that control the rod industry, Jay, they'd have you to believe you need a lot. That's the secret. You know, to each their own on that topic. I know a lot of guys that are like, you know, they're all about, they've got to have, this is that rod, this is that rod, this is that rod. To me, being on the water nonstop, I want to feel like a very good harmony with that one rod. Yeah, I don't want to pick up another rod and do this and do that. Now, I'll tell you a funny factoid, Jay Bird. You ready for this? Are you sitting down?
Yeah.
So somebody I've become pals with that kind of most people wouldn't think of is Mr. Rick Klun, who we'll have on the podcast here soon. Right? Jay, you know who Rick is.
Absolutely.
So he is the goat of bass fishing. Like he is the legend's legend, I would say. I mean, I don't think that'd be an overstatement. Yeah, I mean, it's like, I think he's Kevin Van Damme's favorite fisherman. You know, it's like Rick Klun
right,
is
in perspective. Yeah,
he is the goat, boys. And literally, I think there was a show ESPN like ranked the best fisherman of all time, and Rick Klun was ranked number one.
Wow, that's cool,
right? And that's in the modern era when they did it. It's not like, oh, they did that in the 70s or something. Like Rick Klun, that he can fish, right? And one of the funniest things that I learned from Rick, and we were just sitting down. I mean, we're not, you know, just two guys sitting around talking nothing. And we were talking about kind of the industry and business end of things. And then we got into the rods thing. And I was like, how many rods did you use? And then it wasn't like, oh, how many rods? I was like, how many rods do you
use? Right, because we've all seen, right, you know, probably right, a current bass episode, something on TV, because they saturate it, right?
I was in.
And these guys will run 12.
Dude, I was in.
They'll have 12 on the deck all rigged up, which is nice, you know, if you need to switch from a quarter ounce flipping jig to a, you know, half ounce, you know, because you're working a little bit deeper. I need a spinner bait right now, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, great.
Nope.
No wasted time, tournaments, money, you know. But yeah.
But
what did Rick say? What's his
take? It was crazy because, I mean, you're saying that about all the rods. I just did a thing with Laker Howe, who won that, whatever, you know, and I was in his boat and it's like covered in rods. And I'm sitting there with Rick and I expect the typical answer because I only throw one rod. He said, rod companies hate me. So good enough for the greatest angler of all time to throw one rod. Now, Rick doesn't need nor care about a rod endorsement. There's that. Take that for what you will. And, you know, I think realistically, you know, I don't know. I've never talked to him about, you know, if he's throwing big swim baits. I don't think that's really his forte per se. But I'm going, okay, this dude is the GOAT, and he did it with one rod. And to reiterate what I've always said on it and just, you know, the thought process, I said, well, why you only throw one? I knew the answer. There's only can be one. The man can afford more than one rod, Jay. So the other answer is the obvious one. He literally goes, I want to be absolutely in 100% tactile feel and control of that rod. That's it. I went, I'll be damned.
And you can't get it from switching all the time is what he's saying. Because I got 12-pound mono on this one. I got super line on this one. Yeah. This one's a 6.6. This one's a 7.
Yep.
It's got a heavier action. It's a different rod brand. It's a different feel.
Right.
This has got a
titanium tip. This one has a steel tip. And the dude flat out said, I fished one rod, so I know exactly what it feels like. So I know
that
Know what my bait is doing. The same crap we have said about it for eons. And I went, I'll tell you flat out, when it comes to how many musky rods you have, I have been on an island of one when it comes to that topic. Right. Where you look at everybody else kind of like, and again, you know, other anglers have been endorsed by this company or that company, or like, you know, Booker back in the day, it's like, you need, you know, you got your long ranger, your short ranger, your cranking stick, your flipping stick, your, you know, you need all those rods.
Right.
And I sure as shit felt like I wasn't on an island of one. Now he's a bass angler, but he's the GOAT. And the same conclusion was it's a tactile thing, right? If I pick up 10 rods, if I took 10 9.6 shield rods and put the same reel, put next level braid on them, the same leader, they're all going to feel different. Every one of them. Every one of those rods. And it is every time I've ever owned a different musky rod, like, and I don't mean a different brand, like I'll buy, before we had the shield rods, Jay, I was fishing the Shimano Skix.
If you recall that brand,
right? I do. Had three of them. I had one good one, in my opinion, right?
Just like guitars.
Right, just like guitars. Some are better than others. You know, this is my rifle. This is my gun. There are many like it.
Well, I got 4 Stratocasters, but guess what? Yeah, go ahead.
But to that point, it's not that the rod's bad. It just didn't jive. Right? And it's one of those deals in the brand before. I ran St. Croix before that. Before that, I ran a bunch of other brands. And I would find one that worked. And I went, okay, that's the one. And the others were backups that I prayed I didn't have to use. And it's not because, like I said, you don't walk in and magically, if you don't know better, I hate to say this, if you don't know what a good rod feels like, you're not going to go in the store and find one. Sorry. But it's like you brought up the guitar thing. Take it to the music thing. Hundreds and hundreds. I've owned more guitars than I even care to mention, right? I mean, hundreds and hundreds, if not over 1,000 over the years. But you end up with the ones that you go, okay, that's the one. And it's not because, you know, people don't sell vintage guitars because they hate them. And the point I'm going to make is this. They go, they didn't like it, right? So, I mean, I'm sitting here. Sometimes you'll hear me, like, on the show. I'll just, you know, pick up, do that in the background or whatever. It's just kind of a nervous tick I have, but you know, I'm sitting here with one of my Strats, and it's like, I bought this from a guy that hated it. Jay absolutely despised this guitar. He was like, he was so glad to get rid of, like, you're a fool if you want that. And it's one of my favorites, if not the favorite that I have, because it works for me. So that's the other thing. I don't get freaked out, like, I can't find a magic rod, and you're walking into Musky Shop or Cabela's and you're just like, you know, when do you get the next shipment of rod? Will there be a magical one in there? That's not the point of this. I'm just going, when do you connect with one, right? When does everything, you're not forfeiting anything, right? There's no this, there's no that. You know, I could crawl down the rabbit hole of things I've noticed, but it's immaterial at this point. But I think it's important to have one that's physically comfortable and then just throw in that rod. Because the more you mix it up, the more chances you have that you're focused on using it opposed to it being an extension of what you're doing.
Yeah, all the different rods out these days, too. You know, you think about all the different base material for the handles, right?
Dude,
there's the EVA foam, there's cork, there's different types of cork. Yeah, and the diameter is a huge thing. The diameter of the handles and the foregrip are huge. That's the same thing to guitar necks, right? You know what I mean? You're going to find something that really fits you if you try enough of them.
Right. You just don't go, oh, I like that one because it's purple. But to that point, and I'll use guitars as an analogy here. There's a lot of people that buy guitars and can't play them because they just are never going to be able to. And they look at them. And sometimes if you buy something like that and it's just like, no matter what you do, it ain't going to click. Right. I cannot fathom. If for some reason, for me, it is an impossibility for me to sit there and switch rods all day and feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I go, what? Now I'm thinking about how I'm holding the thing. That feels different. And the most important word in anything that I do on the water is feel.
Yeah. And you pick up something different. You're constantly trying to zone in on
just
working everything. The bait, right? Yeah, everything went in terms of
my mechanics are different.
The feedback from from the lure, you know.
I mean, I am, you know, if you've been on the boat with me, rare on occasion there'll be two laying there, right? And that's if I'm throwing Krakens. You can know I'm throwing Krakens on my boat if I got two rods up front. But outside of that, it is like one rod, one reel, and I'm just done with it.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just done with it. And it's just like, you know, I don't need Jay. It's a say. Okay. If you don't play guitar, we apologize for the analogies. It's the same difference as fricking, you know, Jeff Beck or Jimi Hendrix walking in. They plug into a Marshall and it sounds, or Eddie Van Halen. They didn't use any pedals, boys. They used the amp. They plugged into it and they played like them. Right. And you got Goober McGee with two pedal boards, a flight case full of rack effects, and he still sounds like shit. Right? So it's feel. Now, you can't develop feel, but you can work on it. Right? You can't just think, oh, I have no feel, and I'm supposed to, you know, if you're clumsy, you're not going to become an acrobat. But you can work on what you have, which I think is important in the way that you get any feel, especially if you're fishing. Say you're fishing like, not the guy that just did a trip a week, but you're fishing like a few times throughout the month, right? Forgo the awkwardness of, okay, this rod's different than that rod. This is that, right? It should be second nature in my mind. It should just be fluid. It should be no questions asked. It just picks this thing up and I can go. Wow, that is a way longer answer than it should have been, but I went down a rabbit hole hard.
No, I'm just thinking too, because you know, what did you say? You know, I've narrowed it down to I'm a one rod guide or something like that. Uh-huh. But it's just like I bring out two, and they are the same model actually, but they have a different feel. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a different reel on each rod. Yeah, I've just been thinking about that while you were talking.
I don't want to do it.
So there is a little bit of it's just like I'll bring up, you know, it I'll. Light, heavier, you know what I mean? It's just like, I don't switch baits a lot, but it's just like appropriate bait for different areas. I'm working different areas, and it's like I will switch rods here and there.
Right.
And I was just thinking about that because it's just like it takes some a little bit of time for me to dial back in every time I switch.
I don't know what it is.
Never really realized that.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
It feels different. And I mean, to me, it's like, okay, my game plan in musky fishing is pretty simple. Focus on running depth and location above all else. If you haven't figured that out, it's kind of where my head's at, right? Proximity to a fish. How do I get proximity dialed down? By positioning the boat right. Where do I position the boat? Understand structure and seasonality and yada, 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 right? I don't want to think about, okay, I'm switching to an Akuma Komodo from a Tranks 400 and it's going to feel different, but that's my jerkbait rod. And now it's just not as fluid. I promise you, I don't care who it is. Let's see a dude with like 10 musky, or not even 10, something realistic, like 4 to 5 musky rods, right? Is the fluidity there? Are the mechanics the same? Is the casting distances, all that changes, right? If you have a different rod length, you have different reels, there's going to be adjustments you're making. I just like to go, even if I'm doing it wrong, it works for me. Because I go, that's it, right? I don't need the bullshit to think about this or make small adjustments. I just throw the bait on there. The old trope in musky fishing has been, can you throw it? You can throw any musky bait with proper mechanics. But guess what most people don't want to work on, Jay? There you go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can fling a giant killer, heck, not even lighter than that. Just my, you know, I'll take what's called AC Shiner, which is essentially a bass bait made of balsa wood, and wing it. But I know where the flex point in that rod is. I can feel it. So there's a feel in my cast, and it's getting distance every time and whatever. That comes from spending time with the equipment and getting it down, opposed to I need to put up, you know, whatever. Rabbit hole mm-hmm. bad. No, next yeah. one up, Brandon. New to the community, new to content and education. This is my first season being able to say I'm actually a musky angler. Without being too long-winded, thank you for everything you do. You're welcome. He said, I'm still the guy fishing out of an old ranger. Hear the joke about it on the podcast, way too hard. You might have missed it. It's not about old rangers. If you own an old ranger, you're not who we're poking fun at. We're poking fun at the boomers is who we're poking fun at, Jay. Explain what a patch pirate was back in the day, Jay. They show
Little
up.
Patch boy?
Yeah, patch boys. And if you didn't have a ranger, you were a poser. It has nothing
to do. Some guys used to run the jackets, and they had a lot of different patches on there.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool. Yeah, satin jackets sometimes, right. Too.
Just poking fun at that. Yeah, if you have a ranger, it's not you. If you know, that's a whole different dynamic. So he's going at electronics. Let me paraphrase. Give me a second. Okay, so he's got a current electronics. I have two collars marking 0 to 12 feet and 15 to 30. If the fish were sleep deep. Okay, anyway, to that point, there's a lot here, buddy. I apologize. Okay. So, for the main thing I'd say, he's asking about positioning, where to put it, where to put the graph, right? And things like that. So, first and foremost, if you are, I don't care if you're a guide or you're just fishing on your own, you need to have that position where you can see it while casting, and it becomes, again, a second nature thing, right? You shouldn't have to be thinking about it. So position your graphs where they're convenient for you to see at all times. That's it, right? From the point of we're talking earlier about these big important things going on with, you know, finding giants or whatnot. Well, I want to see my down scan. I want to see my graph. I want to see my live scope all at one time, because I go, oh, crap, there's a rock down there. Right? That didn't show up on the map. And there's a 2-foot boulder on the bottom at 25 feet. And you go, oh, that was important. Right? I want to see everything at one time in the cleanest fashion, in a way that it's not obstructive to your fishing, first and foremost. The only other thing I'd say, because he's asking for like that, just overall tip, you've got two color lines, 0 to 12 and 15 to 30. Break it down more. And if you can't break it down more, get a graph that will. I find that it's important to break down the water with coloration, right? So my graph kind of looks like a poster for a reggae concert, where it's every color of the rainbow, right?
Sure. We'll make it overly easy. Right. You're glancing at that thing. You're not staring at it while you're fishing.
Right.
You want to glance at it and understand what's around you.
You know, right now I'm 0 to 5, is red. Orange is like, I can't remember how it falls. So it's like 0 to 5 or it's 5 to 10, whatever. But I actually mark 0 to 5 and then I'll mark 5 to 8. Okay. Then I'm marking 8 to 12. Now, something that's important about that 12-foot zone is the littoral zone where vegetation typically grows. You want something denoting 12 feet, especially for summer and fall fishing. That really gives you an idea where that edge generally will be, right, in most circumstances.
Lakes differ, but yeah, yep. You're dialed in for your specific common fishing ground, right. So that makes a lot of sense.
So to that 12 mark, right, and then from 12, I like to take the jump to 12 to 16 as another area. Now, mm-hmm. Based on light penetration, vegetation can change, but also, too, let's say I'm on a general colored lake, general weed growth. I know beyond 12, there's not a lot, but I catch a hell of a lot of muskies out of the scruffy stuff on the very outside of weed edges. So having that bandwidth marked is important for me, right? Subsequently, taking out from that 16 to 20, and then after that, I'll go maybe out to 25, out to 30, depending on where I'm at. But marking that really breaks down those key areas. So I think it's important on your graph to have multiple colorations if you can get it, right? And dial that in. And where at a glance, you know what you're happening. And also, too, you know, that's a big jump in my mind from like 12 to 0. Those are different worlds, right? And so unless you're looking, if let's say you catch a fish, and you can't really determine where it came from out of there, and you weren't paying attention to your down scan, and you didn't know the boat was sitting in 10, and you cast it up to 8, you didn't narrow your scope. So narrow the focus as much as you can, because narrowing your focus helps with patterning. Dan the man, last one. I got to go freaking eat Mexican food. Please don't delete this email. Sorry. He must have been in the group from last week.
Last week, the accident happened. I remember it.
Dun, dun, dun. For clear bodies of water and fishing with suckers, would you have a down rod 6 to 8 feet out of the back or deeper, then have a 6 to 8 foot bobber set up to 5 to 10, a single tail or double post turn? Okay.
Ooh.
So cutting down to this, clear water, should we have our sucker at 6 to 8 out of the back? Then have a bobber set up, you know, kind of trailing. I like keeping it over the side of the boat. I'm not a big bobber guy when it comes to suckers. I want to keep them like right where I want them. Right? He also asked single tail or double bulldogs post turnover. Definitely the season, a bigger rubber. So if given the choice, I'll go with the double dog. But sucker positioning, how people like to do it. I like to have that sucker, let's say there's two guys casting, I want it right in between them. Split the difference where nobody's hitting it in the figure eight, if you can, right? And I want to lead fish to that. Now, it depends. I mean, if you can run more than one sucker, have a trailer sucker, but my take is always going to be something that I have focused. No matter what, I'm always running weights on suckers, Jay. And I've seen suckers that are 10 inches long move a 2 ounce weight out of fear, right? But I've also seen little suckers, if I don't have a weight on them, they're swimming all over the surface, like doing nothing.
Some suckers want to do that. Yeah. And I think it depends on the lake, but mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's another thing with using bobbers too. I think that really restricts the freedom that they have.
Sucker because freedom.
Because they start to, you know, they start want to go into a direction, and all of a sudden there's all this resistance. So that depends. Suckers can help in a weedy situation, though. Go ahead.
Yeah, the way I like to roll with, and I'm just keeping it on the weed edge. If they're coming up, I'll go over there, reel him up a little bit, let him go over the top of those, dropping back down. Always run my suckers on a line counter rod. We talked about the rod stuff earlier, like specified trolling rods, but you can troll without them. But I like a line counter for my suckers just so I know exactly where he was set. Right.
But yeah, and they have great audible line coloring alarms too.
But I always run a weight on them. I want if you don't know what's going on and you can't look at the water and go, okay, this is what I should be doing, then you need to, you know, just play with it throughout the day. But to really dial in on it, you go, I'm putting 2 ounces of weight on this thing because I know where he needs to be. And most of the time, if you're fishing those depths, he needs to be right at those weed tops or right at that structural edge. Those fish are going to come off the bottom, so why make them work harder than they should? And then suckers on a bobber, like I said, I'd probably flee to the surface too. So that's just a kind of take on it anyway, Jayburn. We gabbed and we gabbed. What are you going to give the kids for Halloween this year?
Coloring books.
64 packs of crayons.
With an auto sharpener built into the back.
Right there in the back. Just crayon scraps all over the Honda. Just full of filthy children. Anyway, good God.
Color up that muskie, kids.
Color it up,
I tell you. Use a little bit more magenta on the dorsal.
Look at this picture, little Billy collared of this muskie on the fridge. Oh,
it's beautiful, I tell you.
It's beautiful. All right, Jaybird, say good night.
All right, guys, thanks.
Later.
Bye-bye now. Let the muskies hit the floor. Let the muskies hit the floor. Let the muskies hit the floor.